Welcome back, listeners, to Miss the Movies. I'm Erin, and I'm so glad you guys could be here today. Thank you for joining us as we dive into our favorite movies and learn about fairies, trolls, mythical monsters, and folklore. Today, I wanted to talk about gnomes. We're taking a break from our scary movie summer and talking about these little gnomes. So I'm talking about the little statues in your garden. So technically, those are garden gnomes. Gnomes, they go all the way back to the 16th century. So I thought the movie we would focus on are the gnomes in Harry Potter. Now, they're not featured in the movie, to my great disappointment, but I want to briefly mention it because I find it hilarious. In Harry Potter, gnomes live in gardens, and they are quite annoying. Here is a quote from Harry Potter fandom at Wikipedia. Newton Scamander recommended in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them that swinging the gnome around one's head until dizzy and then dropping it over the garden wall was sufficient, but some wizards, like the Weasley family, preferred to throw the gnomes as far as possible, sometimes even having competitions as to who could toss a gnome the farthest. De-gnoming was considered to get easier as the process went on, as the gnomes would emerge from their holes to investigate the process, thus making them susceptible to being de-gnomed themselves. So yes, they actually come out of their holes and they watch. They watch the whole process. Not exactly the brightest bulb in the socket. And they love the Weasley's house because Arthur Weasley thinks they're really funny, which I do too. And they don't really look like, we sort of think of them as little like Santa Claus figures you put in your garden, but in Harry Potter, they basically look like potatoes with two stubby legs. They've got razor sharp teeth and will bite if provoked. And they lived in burrows underground and they leave little piles of dirt around like a mole. So are you ready for our campfire tale? Here we go. Once upon a time, there lived a very rich king. He owned lots of things, beautiful jewelry, castles, livestock, etc. But the most dangerous thing he owned was a poison tree. Legend says whoever eats from it will vanish underground. The king's young daughters decided to eat from the tree. They know that their father loves them and reason that he would never own anything that could hurt them. Surprise! As soon as they eat the fruit, they fall underground. The king is so worried that he offers a reward to whoever finds them. Whoever can find his daughters will have their hand in marriage. Three brave huntsmen decide they are up to the task. They find a beautiful stone castle, but no one is there. Some food is spread out on a table, so they decide to eat. The other two go out to search while the eldest prepares a meal. As he cuts into some bread, a gnome appears. He begs for some bread, but wants the whole loaf. The huntsman refuses, so the gnome beats him up and takes a loaf of bread. The second brother appears, and he's appalled. He tries to take the bread away, but the gnome beats him up, too. The third brother, the youngest, walks in to see his brothers unconscious and on the floor. The third brother demands the gnome apologize. The gnome agrees and in exchange tells him the girls are in a well with no water. Then he vanishes. The brothers find the well, and they lower themselves down. The eldest and middle brother both panic, so the younger brother lowers himself down. He finds the daughters are being held captive by a fearsome dragon. The youngest brother kills the mighty dragon and puts the girls in a basket so they can be pulled up. The huntsman tries to climb up too, but his brothers cut the rope, stranding it. The youngest brother finds a flute, plays it, and conjures elves who rescue him. Once the king hears the truth about what happened, the brothers are sentenced to hang. The youngest is given the hand of the youngest daughter, and they marry. The end. So this is a wild story, just from beginning to end. This is from the Grimm's Brothers collection. I think it's the fact that the brothers fail at every turn, only to leave the only smart brother in the well. I mean, that's just unbelievable to me. People in these original fairy tales are just so unbelievable to me. They never seem to worry about their actions. They just try to kill their brothers without a moment's hesitation. Must be nice to live without consequences. Although the consequences are very real. They all were set to hang, so it's not good. So now that we know the Grimm's Brothers story, let's define what a gnome is exactly. We know he isn't a garden gnome, but maybe he's close to the Harry Potter myth. So I got this definition from the Encyclopedia Britannica. A gnome is a subterranean goblin or earth spirit who guards mines of precious treasures hidden in the earth. He is represented in medieval mythologies as a small, physically deformed, usually hunchback creature resembling a dry, gnarled old man. So I figured that he was probably like a gnarly old crusty man. I didn't realize he guards mines. That sounds very Snow White. It sounds very Snow White, I know. But it turns out that dwarves and elves are very similar. So they're both small humanoids, but gnomes primarily live underground. It's been suggested that the Latin root of their name means earth dweller. So they live underground while dwarves live in forests. Also, in folklore, gnomes hate people, whereas dwarves are much friendlier and interested in people. Also, the word gnome comes from the German mythology, whereas dwarves originated from Norse mythology. So, a little bit different. However, after the success of Snow White, gnomes have sort of merged with dwarves in how they look. Although a case could be made that most people know of gnomes as primarily garden gnomes, the little Santa lookalikes that live in your garden. So let me tell you all about the origins of gnomes. The first written document to have mentioned gnomes is called A Book on Nymphs, Sylphs, Pygmies, and Salamanders, and on Other Spirits, which is a great name. It was written by Paracelsus. He was a Swiss guy who spent a lot of time in Germany, and he was one of those scholars who basically fancied themselves a jack of all trades. He was a physician, alchemist, lay theologian, and philosopher of the German Renaissance, and he really thrived around the early 1500s. Think of sort of an egghead figure. Paracelsus actually wasn't his real name. That was the moniker he was given. His real name was Philippus Aurelius Theo Pratus Bombidus von Hohenheim, which is way too much. Anyway, so he was basically a sciencey guy that was trying to make sense of the world around him. And since everyone believed in mythology, he tried to merge that into science. I would love it if he tried to form the basilisk test and actually put a rooster on trial to see if it was a basilisk, but unfortunately he did not. But we have to give him some credit. He was the first to name zinc. He named the mineral that because it was jagged and sharp, and the High German word for sharp is zinc. Interesting. He was the first to name gnomes. Some sources claim he invented the creatures out of whole cloth. That is sort of undetermined. There have always been creatures associated with caves, earth, and precious minerals going back to probably ancient Rome, but he was the first to describe them in a book. So good for him. Basically, Paracelsus was describing the Euclidean concept of the four elements, earth, fire, water, and air. Gnomes represented earth, and undine represented water, sylph, air, and salamanders, fire. So what is an undine? That's a water nymph. And a sylph is similar to a wood fairy or nymph, sort of an air spirit. Very ambiguous. And salamanders, you're probably thinking, well, that's not fire related at all. Well, he's associating salamanders with dragons and then associating that with fire. So like it's a little bit 1 degree separated from fire. So he wrote that while they're invisible to humans, each is a physical being, so they need food, sleep, and clothing, much like we do. Each being can freely move through their own element. So a gnome can pass through rocks, walls, and soil as effortlessly as a fish through water. Each being stays healthy when surrounded by their own element, but would sicken and die if exposed to others. So that's interesting. A little gnome could just pass through a rock. That makes total sense. But he's trying to sort of integrate fairy mythology with science. It's coming out kind of in a strange thing, like 2 + 2 = apples. But I kind of get where he's going with this. And, you know, this is the 1500s, so we're going to give him a lot of slack. The only thing, though, is the gnomes don't really make a lot of sense. Every other creature is well represented in mythology before this point, but gnomes really aren't. Gnomes were new, and many believe Paracelsus came up with the name himself. So where did he get this idea? Well, most people think that he drew upon the creature known as a pygmy. There's a lot of bad associations with that word, but in this case, I'm not talking about people. There is a mythological creature called a pygmy, and it is most similar to a fairy. They are first mentioned in the Iliad way back in the 8th century BC. Homer describes them as a sort of gnarled old man, but very small. So he says they are less than 3 spans tall, and a span is the distance between your thumb and your pinky. So for a man, that's usually about 7.5 inches. We'll say 8 so I can multiply easily. That's about 21 to 24 inches high. So they're not Thumbelina size. Thumbelina is much smaller. She's about 1 inch high, and she can sleep on a lily pad. Which that was such a romantic movie to me, that she could sleep on a lily pad. Like, that's just so sweet and just, again, just so romantic. Such a romantic idea. Anyway. So the pygmies, they lived in a remote mountainous region where they were conducting an ongoing war with the cranes, who would migrate to the pygmies' homelands every winter. So they became a popular figure in Greek pottery. And I've got a picture I'll put on Twitter and Instagram of a crane and a pygmy fighting. So the crane thing, it was said that the queen of pygmies boasted that she was even lovelier than Hera. And Hera shut her down. She transformed the pygmy queen into a crane. And ever since then, the cranes have bothered the pygmies. So the pygmies often raid the nest, stomping on eggs and shooting the cranes with arrows. And then, of course, our favorite Roman history author, Pliny the Elder, he had to chime in. And he talks more about raids and stuff, but he also explains that they live in houses made of mud and feathers. So after Paracelsus names them, they become more popular. And they really kick up their popularity in the 18th century. They change a lot, mostly from writer to writer. They are predominantly featured in the satire poem, The Rape of the Lock, which I thought was about raping a girl, like the rape of Persephone or something. It is not. So in this case, the word means carry off. Like, it doesn't mean sexually assault. What happens is a suitor of Arabella, the main character, he steals a lock of her hair. Which, I mean, I am so not into that Victorian tradition of hair. Like, putting it in a lock, trading it with your lover. It's just so weird to me. I don't want your hair. Keep your hair. It's so weird. And then, of course, you got people like Caroline Lamb who take it way too far. I'm not going to say exactly what happened with her, but you can look it up. Just know what happened. She fought with Lord Byron. And, you know, anything that someone could do to torture Lord Byron is A-okay in my book, because I really don't like him. Anyway, the poem basically mocks the Greek epics by comparing it to the minor offense of stealing hair. The Sylphs vow to protect her and her hair. They fail, and then the gnomes battle to win it back. So it's basically a joke about the Greek epic, about the Greek epics, which is totally different than what I thought. So that poem is really super popular, and it establishes gnomes in the public's mind. It's not until the 19th century that gnomes start to merge with goblins. So gnomes are considered of the earth, meaning that they spend 100% of their time below ground, just kind of like a mole, which my garden is currently infested with voles, like the little mouse guy. They're like little mice, and I'm not into it anyway. So the 19th century is really when you see gnomes become part of the fairy tale canon and less of a creature you might actually see. And the reality part of the creatures continues to fade as the years go by. However, there is a notable exception. There is a very famous incident in 1979 when a group of gnomes were spotted. So let's set the stage. It's England. It's a beautiful public park and a very large one. I've got some photos that I'll put on Instagram or Twitter. A dozen or so children about the age of 8 to 10 are playing by the lake. It's September, the days are getting cooler, the sun has set, and now the magical time of dusk sets in. There's enough light to see, but just barely. It's around 8:30. The children's attention was attracted by something that sounded like a bell. They saw a throng of around 60 little gnome-like men coming out of an area of woodland and bushes which had been fenced off to prevent the general public from entering. The little men were riding in small bubble-like vehicles. These cars were completely silent, but they were very quick and could jump and skip over anything in their way, such as a fallen tree or branch. Down near the lake, they seemed to be enjoying riding over the marshy, swampy area, and a few of them chased the children toward the exit gate from the park, just in play, though, not aggressively. So what did these things look like? The little men were half the size of the children, around 2 feet tall. They all had wrinkled faces, maybe with a greenish tinge, and long white beards tipped with red. Sometimes they laughed in a strange way. They had blue tops and yellow or green tights or pants. On their heads, they were wearing what children described as caps, like the old-fashioned nightcaps. They looked very similar to a famous character in England called Naughty, and I will post that on our Instagram too. So what happened? They played for a while, and then the children ran home as it was late. So did they tell their parents? They sure did. They told their parents. They told the headmaster. They repeated the story over and over again, all questioned separately, just like Law and Order SVU says to do. And they drew little pictures of them, and I will post that to Instagram because you really need to see it. And the picture, it kind of looks like if you've ever seen a Shriner in like a little small car, that's kind of what it looks like. So the parents didn't believe them, but the headmaster did, which is the opposite of what I would have thought. But nothing happened after that. There were a couple more sightings, but nothing was ever followed up on. So, yeah, that's the story. That's the big famous gnome story. So do I believe that it happened? No, I'm sorry. I don't. Kids have a hard time differentiating between reality and make-believe. And I think that they probably were playing a great game and they were sort of talking to each other and just having a good time and pretending that there were gnomes or that little naughty creature and it had come and played with them and they were just having a good time. That's my guess would be their imagination just sort of caught away with them. So that's it for gnomes. Now I'm going to tell you about the whole garden gnomes thing. So how did that happen? How did gnomes become part of people's garden? So that actually dates back to about the 1700s. Technically earlier, wealthy Romans would place small grotesques around their gardens. But what we know of garden gnomes actually comes from the 1700s. These were little carvings, usually wooden, particularly popular in Switzerland and Bavaria. Germany sort of adopted them into their mythology as little elves and whatnot, helpers and protectors. Their popularity waxed and waned, but took off again after Snow White came out in the 30s. The dwarves were made into little gnome likenesses and then exaggerated with little beards until we get the sort of Santa-like appearance they have now. And then in the 90s, people would steal each other's lawn gnomes and then take pictures of them as if the gnome had gone on vacation. And now it seems like people are making their own art with it. I went down a rabbit hole and found some YouTube videos where people make these amazing gnome houses. I put the links in the show notes if you listeners are interested. They're pretty incredible. So that's all I know about gnomes. Oh, wait, there's one more fact. The Chelsea Garden Show has banned gnomes because they detract from the garden designs. The ban was lifted in 2013 to mark the 100th anniversary of the show. The 100-year anniversary of the show. Gnome enthusiasts accuse the organizers of snobbery, as garden gnomes are popular in the gardens of working class and suburban households. Probably a legitimate criticism. I mean, you know, rich people are always trying to prove that they're better than poor people. Although I don't know if the Chelsea Garden Show is really where I want to like draw my line in the sand, because I would imagine you would have to be pretty wealthy to enter it or like really cultivates, like in order to get the fancy flowers, you have to send off for those and buy them. And I'm sure it's pretty expensive, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. The only thing I know about flower shows is from Downton Abbey when they were showing off their roses, and Maggie Smith kept winning, and she said it wasn't possibly because of the fact that she was the rich, you know, landowner, and everybody there was basically working for her. She was like, no, it's really because mine are the best, which lame. Maggie Smith, you know what's up. Anyway, this was our episode of Gnomes. Kind of a short and sweet this week. Couldn't really go to, there's not that much about gnomes, so I thought we would just do a little fun little episode. Listeners, if you do gnome art or if you've seen a gnome, please contact us. I would love to see it. You can tweet at us over at Myths and Movies or email us at mythsandmovies@gmail.com. For more stuff or supporting the show, we've got fun stuff over on Patreon. And most importantly, hit the subscribe button and give us a 5-star review. And as always, we know that you have many choices when you podcast, and we are so glad that you have chosen to spend this lovely time with us. Thank you, listeners. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.